All right, everybody, welcome to Yeah But Still. Brandon, how you doing over there? We have an exciting episode in the works, I think.
This is a special, I would say that this is a very special episode of Yeah But Still.
I'd say one of those where it's like a long time coming.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, this is
for the guest does not know that, though.
Right.
It's a long time coming for us, a patron saint of this podcast, maybe, I'd say. Definitely a touchstone of influence.
I would say so. I mean, I would say that the show that he was on is a patron saint of the podcast, but also the new movie he's in is really amazing, and I don't want that to get lost.
Absolutely not.
But
to get to the point, joining us very soon.
The Kid Detective and the OC, Adam Brody.
Adam Brody is joining us very soon, along with writer-director of the movie, Evan Morgan. We'll talk about them. We both loved Kid Detective. It's this new movie that Evan directed and Adam's in. But Adam Brody, I mean, I'm a little nervous over here, Brandon, to be honest with you, because Seth Cohen, the OC, I mean, emblematic for me, and I don't want to go full Chris Farley mode where I'm just like describing the show to him,
right?
You know, but that's kind of like where my instincts are. To be like, do you remember when you had the band come and play on the show, and you got to meet Modest Mouse, and
I mean, the music on that show, there was like a full episode that's basically just an infomercial for Rooney.
Yeah, Rooney's really like really present in that show.
Yeah, there's like, well, because Oliver, the weird guy who's obsessed with Marissa, but Marissa doesn't understand that he's like he's twisted.
Yeah.
He invites her to the Rooney concert. Ryan, he's protective of his girl, and he's kind of being distant, and like he's bothered. And Marissa, you know, she comes up behind him. She's like, "Ryan, why are you sad? Rooney's a really good band, you know?" And yeah, that episode is like, I mean, the music on that program is like seminal.
Well, honestly, I don't think I realized it until after the fact, but it put so many so much like indie music that went mainstream is because of that show.
Yeah.
Which I didn't, when it came out, I was in high school, I think, and or middle school, I can't remember, but like I was listening to that music, and then I didn't realize like when it became like those bands became massive, it was because of the OC, you know, like Death Cab for Cutie. Right. They became like huge.
Sure.
It just went into the mainstream of culture, you know?
Right. And also just music that was already big, but like cool. Like they had a lot of cool music moments.
Oh no. Death
on
like,
that program. Yeah.
They weren't like Death Cab was a big band. But this was all of a sudden it was on MTV. You know,
yeah,
that vibe.
I was last night, you know, Adam Brody and Evan, they're on the books. And so I revisited the OC last night, and it's the episode with the Paris Hilton cameo.
Oh, where there's my like, God, yes.
It's a very like kind of meta episode where it's, you know, Summer is obsessed with some show called The Valley, you know, whatever. meets Colin Hanks, who meets the guy who's playing who's the Adam Brody of the fake OC on this program. And it's right after the movie Orange County just came out.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot
of
play
like
here.
A big time for Southern California.
Yes. Yeah, so this is right after the Colin Hanks, Jack Black film Orange County just came out. And it's Colin Hanks playing Adam Brody, basically, on a fake OC show. And they, you know, whatever. It's like, it's a funny enough episode, but there's this like Paris Hilton cameo that's like super like they like shoehorn in this like Thomas Pynchon reference.
Yeah.
Where it's like supposed to be like it's Paris Hilton shows up and it's like, oh, you think she's stupid, but she's actually smart. And she like bumps into Seth Cohen at the club.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, hey, how are you? And she's like, oh, I'm tired. I've been staying up all night working on my thesis. It's about magical realism in American literature. Are you familiar with the works of Thomas Pynchon?
Hi. How's How's it going?
I'm so exhausted.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've been up all night working on my thesis. Magical realism in American literature. Are you familiar with the works of Thomas Pynchon?
I've only read The Crying of Lot 49.
Gravity's Rainbow is his masterpiece. Don't tell anyone I'm in grad school.
Doesn't he get her number on that episode too?
Yes. Yeah.
Like Seth Cohen gets her number. It was very, I forgot about that one because it's like so referential and very meta. And
right.
And also, like, I just forgot how much of culture was circled around the suburbs of Southern California at that time. I mean,
right.
Not to mention, I mean, I'd say like the Dark Triad, at least one point in the triangle is Hollister as a brand. Remember how hot Hollister was?
Yeah, Hollister was like big on, and it had Cali on the thing.
Live feed of, was it Newport Beach that they had?
I think so.
Yeah, a lot was happening in Orange County. You know, Hollister was huge. Everybody around the country was dressing like in Hollister clothes, which was supposed to
be the OC is, it's a show that I watched much later because of, because of what it represented to me in culture at the time, where I was like, oh, that's what popular kids watch.
I thought so too.
So
I only noticed the effects of it because there were like a couple popular girls that like became indie overnight in my school and like tried to be emo and would like all of a sudden try to come sit at our lunch table, and it would be very like, we are very suspicious, you know?
Right.
We're like some girl, like, that was a thing that would happen in high school. Like some, like a popular kid would just like get clothes, apparently, like get a band t-shirt and like skinny jeans and like show up to school. And it's just like, oh, I'm emo now. I'm alt now. And then try to get in. And it was weird. We were all very suspicious. But now I realize like, oh, they probably had a crush on Seth Cohen and were trying to come get their own, trying to find their own Seth Cohen in school and listen to Death Cab.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then they finally,
I mean,
then everybody's a dick to them probably at that real life lunch table, because it's like, what the fuck are you doing here?
Right. These preps.
Yeah.
I did. Like, it was like a show that I came to appreciate years later.
Oh, it's a great show.
Well, seasons one and two are a great show.
Yeah.
Seasons three and four can fucking suck my dick. But seasons one and two, that's like, Those that was heat.
Those were the days for sure.
Yeah.
All-star cast, I'd say.
Yeah.
Great cameos, wild cameos.
Yeah.
And the music, most importantly, I'd say, you know.
Yeah.
Had a big impact. That's for sure. And you know,
no,
just
for sure.
But Seth Cohen, obviously, standout character.
Yeah.
Easily.
You know. A heartthrob.
Absolute heartthrob. But yeah, I don't know. I'm very like we've referenced this a lot on the podcast before, and I have a lot going in my mind. I'm very excited for this interview. I also liked Kid Detective a lot, so
yeah, Kid Detective rocks.
The shit in my head's like too, I don't know. Like I have like very big thoughts about the OC, and I need to not like go full nerd mode. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
because it's just interesting. We were talking about, there's like QAnon people. Some of the cast members have become QAnon.
Yeah, I mean, Anna's like from the Seth Summer Anna love triangle.
Yeah.
Has taken a sharp MAGA turn.
Kevin Sorbo.
And Kevin Sorbo. Who I didn't realize, like, so Kevin Sorbo is, Ryan's shitty dad.
Yeah.
Yeah,
who's went on to make like a series of weird Christian movies, and is also like, I mean, just the other day, he had a very funny series of tweets during the storming of the Capitol. He was like, sent him to you, Brandon, I think. There was like three tweets where he was just basically like, the first one was when people were marching to the Capitol. He's like, it's happening. And the next one was like, like basically just being like, soldiers, be careful, be smart out there, like, good luck, I wish you the best while you storm the Capitol. And then the third one was like a couple hours later after it all went south. And he's like, Antifa was clearly behind this. That was all clearly Antifa.
Right.
There was no Trump supporters storming the Capitol. But yeah, I mean, like he did play a bad guy in the show technically. But I mean, talk about somebody who's made like a weird life plot twist.
I mean, it's a reminder that you can never really like project your political values onto fake people from TV.
Absolutely not.
You can never just assume that like the person from the TV is shares your politics.
Although that being said, perhaps he was the most accurate character in terms of like depicting Orange County. You know,
yeah, and Orange County is, yeah, that's a very red county.
Very red.
You know, yeah, like that is, yeah. I know. I always have a horrible time when I'm in Orange County.
When do you have to go there?
At the damn Irvine Improv.
You've gone.
I've had to like. I've gone to like perform at the damn Irvine Improv at the Irvine Spectrum Center.
Oh, that sounds rough.
Yeah, I mean, it's like not, it was like, I mean, that's a place where people go to just like, it's people that live in Orange County, and the people that go there are oftentimes people that are like, I want to go see comedy at a comedy club.
Yeah.
And then like, I'm performing, and it's like, that's not what they're looking for whatsoever. That's not what you want to fucking see. If you live in Orange County and you go to the mall to see comedy... And just like you're like, oh, I gotta go to the mall to see comedy in general.
Oh, it's in a mall?
And then, yeah, it's in a goddamn, well, like an outdoor mall, but still.
Are we talking like an outlet mall, or is it like?
No, it's like in a damn like it's the Irvine Spectrum Center. It's the fucking. It's like a nice mall, but like, yeah, that's not. I'm not.
Is it
the,
like
the man for that venue?
How close to a Red Robin is this comedy club, like in terms of physical distance?
Oh. I mean, it's definitely close to a Cheesecake Factory.
Okay,
for sure.
That indicates. So we're talking like, I mean,
I would say Grove S.
Yeah, I was gonna say I don't know how to make a reference that a worldwide audience would understand, but similar to the Grove in L.A. So we're talking like a classy joint, you know?
Right.
There's an Apple Store in there. They've got an Apple Store.
It's
maybe
a classy mall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apple Store. I'm looking at the map right now. Okay. Nordstrom.
Yeah.
You got Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. So you know you're getting some chocolates in there.
Yeah, for sure.
Starbucks. I like how.
Yeah,
no,
I just want to plug.
I'm just plugging this mall.
The Irvine Spectrum Center.
Yeah. Maybe we should.
There's a CPK. Yeah, you know there's a fucking goddamn California Pizza Kitchen in there.
Eating up.
Oh, and a fucking...
Oh, there's a Dave and Buster's.
Dave and Buster's.
Oh, wow.
Oh, shit.
Temporarily closed, though.
Yeah. Oh, there's an... Yeah, right. It's right by the Umami Burger. Yes, of course. Yeah, the Irvine Improv right by the Umami Burger.
Anthropology.
Well, that was...
Oh, the Press Juicery.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had a show that was, like, better than kind of mediocre there.
Yeah, I mean, well, you're set up for failure right here if this is the place where you're going to be doing comedy.
Yeah.
Like, let's see. I still haven't actually seen where the improv is. What's it called?
The Irvine Improv?
Irvine Improv. I just need to see what business is next to this.
Yeah.
Oh, it's right next to the AT&T store. We're right next to an AT&T store. Paul Martin's
really
American
the idea
Grill.
I really love the idea of like an OC fan listening to this podcast for the first time. They've never listened to this podcast, and they saw that Adam Brody is on our podcast, and they're fucking like 10 minutes in, and it's just like, yeah, no, there's like a California Pizza Kitchen at this mall, dude.
I mean, this is an accurate depiction of the podcast. So anyway, look, I needed the right info to know for sure that like. You know, this comedy club you had to perform at.
There's a fucking P.F. Chang's in this mall.
Honestly, all this sounds nice.
A nice enough mall.
Mid-pandemic, this is sounding nice. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just like watering at the mouth over here to do a true mall walk, you know?
Yeah.
Get myself a little latte, walk into the Apple store.
Ooh-wee.
Check out the new stuff. I would love it. You know, listen to some music.
No,
some Frank Sinatra.
No oat milk at
just Frank Sinatra blasting at the outdoor mall.
Yeah. It's never not Christmas at the outdoor mall.
That's true.
And that's what that's what Orange County's all about. But that's also, Kid Detective, a fucking great movie, but whatever.
We should
plug that.
This interview,
whatever.
We should
let's
probably
get to the,
start the podcast, and then once we come back, we'll be interviewing Evan Morgan and Adam Brody from the movie Kid Detective, which we're both big fans of. So anyway, welcome to Yeah But Still. Everybody joining us this week, very special guest. Me and Brandon are super excited to have them here. From the movie Kid Detective, we have writer-director Evan Morgan and star Adam Brody. Welcome to the podcast, fellas.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.
I'm feeling great. This is, I mean, movie of the year for me.
Honestly, I agree.
You know,
top three.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's wicked, cool. Guys.
The thing with our podcast, like, we don't have, like, a publicist. We're not on, like, any kind of podcast label or network. So, like, anybody that comes on...
Is this a real show? Is this being recorded?
It's, but, like we only have things on that we really like, you know? And me and Brandon really loved this movie. Kid Detective, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, this came out in theaters briefly pre-COVID. And just like one of those unfortunate
mid COVID.
No, not COVID. Yeah. The height of COVID.
Oh, so you guys were like encouraging people to go out to movies and spread the virus.
It's the opposite. It's the safest place you could be is in a theater seeing this movie by yourself in a room, in a huge room. if you wanted space, seeing The Kid Detective in theaters is about as much space as you could get.
I mean, we both really, really liked it. Evan, this is like your first movie, right? Like your first major directorial debut.
Yeah, it's the first feature that I wrote and directed on my own. I was part of another feature called The Dirties about 7 years ago, which I wrote and edited and co-produced with some friends. And that movie was made by basically four guys in a basement. It was sort of one of those, like found footage movies, kind of like Chronicle, but about a school shooting, kids planning a school shooting.
Oh, wow.
So that premiered, at Slamdance 7 years ago and ended up winning the grand jury prize there. And that's basically how I connected with Adam originally. And I started working on The Kid Detective instantly. Like, this was my follow-up to that. And it's just taken us this long to finally get it financed and made and out into the world. So it's been a crazy, crazy journey.
For the audience who doesn't know, I think a lot of people haven't had the chance to see it yet. It's like a neo-noir. It's about Adam. You play a kind of like washed-up child detective, sort of in the vein of Encyclopedia Brown / The Hardy Boys. I'm assuming those were like inspirations for the movie. I don't know. I loved it. It had like this sort of like really light charm. It was kind of like disconnected from our world that we're living in today. It just like reminded me of like a classic indie movie that you don't kind of come across.
I mean,
these days.
It's a perfect comedy, perfect noir.
Yeah. Were you like a Hardy Boys Encyclopedia Brown fan growing up?
Is this for Adam or me?
Both of you, honestly.
I wasn't. No, I personally, this is Adam. I wasn't. I was, but I think, you know, that still didn't stop me from instantly grasping the premise, even when Evan pitched it to me before I read anything. You know that archetype, even if you didn't read a bunch of it growing up. So you don't really have to have that going in, and you can still have fun with it. It worked to me more. You know, I was pulling from all the detective movies, you know, of adults. That was kind of, you know, what I loved about it. But as well as the kid background. But I mean, like I said, I didn't have a big readership.
It's funny because I was the same way. I actually hadn't read a single Encyclopedia Brown. Still haven't read a single Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew.
Oh wow.
But it was just the idea for the character that like, I think I actually originally had the idea when I was in film school to do like a movie, a short film about a kid detective who was still a kid, but who was solving like grisly crimes in this very sort of dark alternate universe. And I never did it. And then when I was looking for something to work on with Adam, I just was sort of shuffling through my old ideas, stumbled upon this one again, and was like, oh, you know what? What if he was, you know, in his, you know, early 30s and still solving the same kinds of bullshit mysteries? And at that point, it like really sort of sparked for me. And I wrote the first part of the script really quickly, just because the premise implied the world and implied the irony, and the mystery stuff was a lot harder to write. And in order to sort of help me get into that mode, I read like every Encyclopedia Brown book and completely sort of dove in headfirst, as well as like reading a bunch of Raymond Chandler and the more sort of hard boiled stuff. And I also watched a bunch of like detective procedurals and kind of just sort of sucked up as much as I possibly could, just because I felt like very unprepared, you know, to write a mystery. And now, you know, it's much like Adam was saying, it's like, even without having read those books growing up, I think the icon is so, you know, like, it's just so present in North American culture and so familiar and so emblematic of this sort of like wholesome, you know, kind of perfect suburban oasis, which was, you know, for us, the kind of the basis of the satire.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And you touched on something earlier about this, I think, about, you know, not otherworldly, but it's a heightened world. It's its own world. I really loved that instantly and was so curious and excited to help build that world and see how it comes together on a small budget, too, you know, to kind of take something that doesn't exist in our modern day, you know, place and time. And not that it's sort of timeless. It's not that it's a period piece, but it just takes place somewhere else and in a fictitious land. And I just to build that and to build it on a low budget was really fun.
No, absolutely. Brandon, you've been quiet over there. I'm gonna let you jump in.
No, it's, yeah, I mean, it's
I'm hogging it. I'm hogging the mic over here.
No, absolutely. I mean, you're here for the, you know, you've got the serious, you know, interview questions, you know, you're journalist mode.
I'm trying to get to the bottom of all this over here.
Which is, yeah, no, you're kind of, yeah, you're the fucking kid detective of this pod.
That
you
is
know?
True.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is a really fucking great movie. And the whole reason why this podcast came together is because I was posting about it on Instagram. It was like, yep, perfect movie. Evan, you hit me up. And you said that there like hasn't really been, this is like, there hasn't really been any sort of like advertising for the movie. So you're kind of relying on stuff like this right now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
like,
it's again,
word of mouth.
It's just such a strange time. Like, you know, for a Canadian movie to have had a theatrical release that was as wide as ours is insane. Of course, the caveat is that like it was in the midst of a plague and like, you
right,
know,
yeah.
Not
with literally a 4-day runway from when the trailer came out to the movie's release. So they released the trailer on a Monday and it was in like 1,000 screens on Friday. And when I say release the trailer, I mean, put it on the internet. You know,
right.
You know what's funny is that you mentioned that in the movie, the beginning part's supposed to be this kind of utopia, and then as you flash forward to the present tense in the movie, it's supposed to be this dystopian landscape. But in watching it now, even the dystopia is substantially better than the world we're living in right now. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's a funny thing about the times we're living in right now. And it's like that with a lot of shows, just really mundane things kind of come off like a fantasy. I was sort of talking about that. Like when I went back and watched some of the OC to prepare for this, I noticed that was really exaggerated in there for me too. I mean, you know, at the time watching it, there is like drama and problems and stuff. But now when I watch it now, it just seems like a real utopia with like, you know, even the problems were minuscule and their lives are just perfect. You know, it's an absolute fantasy watching it now during the pandemic, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was always looking good.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. It was pretty much. Yeah.
I mean, no, of course. No, they're
like at no point watching the OC was I like, oh, man, these folks. They're down bad.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, that pool house was looking right at all times, you know, not just during the pandemic, but I mean, just like literally right. Seth walking around, having friends, being at the beach, going to parties, like it just feels like a fantasy.
Apropos of very little, except dystopia, the house, the OC house that's in the pilot that we then duplicated on a set, but that is a real house in the pilot, is burned down in the Woolsey fire.
Oh, man.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Dream is dead.
Rest in peace. Yeah, that's very sad. Well, I mean,
someone should definitely make that show. The OC on fire. Yeah, that's a great premise for a revival.
That's kind of fiction, reality imitating fiction, right? Because two episodes in, that house gets damn burned down.
Wow.
Did it?
No, it's what? Another house. It's the model house. But yeah.
The model house. I guarantee you guys are more up to speed on the show than I am.
I was gonna say
I did want to save it for later, but I did want to say that I really admire your anti-reboot philosophy, because I do think that is very like refreshingly dignified. You know.
I think that. I don't know. I don't know that I have I don't have an across the board anti-reboot philosophy personally. I just, with this show, don't have an interest and don't know how you would, you know, I'm sure, listen, I mean, if there's money to be made, they'll figure out a way in, but I just think like, A, there's not a real organic, I don't know, maybe there is. I've never spent the time thinking about it. If you thought hard enough through, bang your head against the wall enough, I'm sure you'd figure out a way in, but you know, I think part of it, I guess, is that at its heart, it's a teen show. It's a high school show. Their parents were heavily involved. They had their own storylines. But at its heart, it's sort of like, and adults really enjoyed it. But at its heart, it's sort of by and for teens and 20 somethings. And so certainly in terms of me, my involvement, like there's nowhere for me to go except to be a parent and kind of check in every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of wild. Like, I didn't realize, I was like watching an episode last night and realized that Marissa Cooper is like 34 in real life at the time.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I'm you know, it's crazy to be, I'm now older than every parent in the pilot except for Peter Gallagher.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah, which is odd, but that's also television. They just cast the women so young. It's kind of gross.
Right. Yeah.
I
no,
mean,
it's
unfair. Grossly unfair.
No. Right. No. They. You know. It's an industry that really fetishizes youth, and it's, you know, get it. You know, fucking early 2000s Fox. But I mean, it's. I guess it never really changed.
No, I mean, not barely. I mean, it's. I think. It's probably inching toward progress right now. You know, I think people are finally talking about it openly, but, you know, it's getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but yeah, reboots generally, I think are, I guess I have an anti-reboot philosophy. Uh-huh. You know, I kind of feel like if you want to fucking watch it, how about you damn reboot that DVD player and just watch the fucking show that you like. Yeah, because it's all very have you seen like Fuller House ever?
Yeah, that's
it really feels like nightmarish.
That, well, you know, there's something I have a real bone to pick with Full House, which is like Fuller House, I should say.
Yeah,
I just watched
like,
one episode and it is nightmarish, but in fairness, probably like the original is too.
Right.
It's fucking insane. In the I only saw the first episode. First of all, if we can just go into Full House for a second,
please.
It's so fucking crazy because the pilot or the premise of Full House is that like he's a widower with three kids, I think, or two kids, three kids, right. And he's a widower. His wife's killed tragically, very young, and they're all going to come together.
Yeah. Did they ever establish how his wife gets killed?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
So okay. So the way they fucking do the reboot is the oldest girl has like three kids and her husband dies.
These people are all dying.
So they all are gonna move in and help her raise the kids. Like, they're the fucking Kennedys or something. Like, just generational tragedy.
Yeah, the Tanner
tragedy.
Legacy.
Yeah.
Golly. So, and then like sweep it under the rug. Like, we're not even going to lean into that. That's just like backstory. Everyone dies in this fucking family, but like tragically young. And everyone's raised without their parents. It's awful. But the other thing I thought was so cheap about it is there's a moment in it. It's just so it's cheap. It's lazy writing. And it's like where they're like, they say something about the Olsen kids.
Oh,
like,
where's
whatever her name was. And they're like, they went off to New York. She went off to New York to be in fashion, and they all beam the camera lens. Like, ugh, this is so lame. Those fucking girls were like 6 months old when they
Holy
signed
shit,
on
yeah.
to your
show. Literal babies.
Yes.
They
yes,
do not I've... have to do, and now they're like self-made billionaires. They do not have to do your shitty reboot.
Yeah.
And they do not deserve right. your scorn for not being part of this fucking shit show. Anyway.
Yeah, shaming these twins that don't want to participate in a thing that they like were cast in without their consent as like fucking infants. It's wild. It is wild. I have gone on this same exact rant.
I'm so amazed that like, you guys so have both glad. Watched the reboot enough to like be having these well, opinions is, at all.
Just the first episode.
I mean, again, like I do think like it's not like like the reboot is you know, I don't bring it up in a way where I'm like it reverent towards the original Full House. Like, I'm not like, oh, this is a disservice to, you know, the legacy of the original Full House. Like, you know, whatever. But, I mean, Fuller House does represent something to me in culture that I think is just so, like, abhorrent, you know, and just fucking, like, nasty. Right? Where, like,
you have to reanimate the corpse all the time, you know?
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's just this, you know, really dumb like cultural Ouroboros human centipede, you know, fucking shitting into our own mouths.
Sure.
And like the end of Fuller House.
Oh, you
is,
made it to the end.
Oh, I made it to the end. I had to I only watched the first episode of Fuller House, and I was like, all right, I understand this.
Oh, the end of the first episode. Okay.
The end of the first episode of No.
I thought you made it to the end of the
last episode of Fuller House. No, I watched the first episode of Fuller House. And
okay,
I was like,
okay.
I'm pissed off. I'm gonna watch this whole run right now. No, the end of the first episode of Fuller House. They there's this scene where they're singing the Flintstones theme song to the like baby of the like new character or whatever, or, you know, the new baby, and they're all like
the new orphan.
Yeah, and they're yes, and they're like doing like this dance and like singing around the fucking crib, and then it cuts to a split screen of that exact scene happening in the original Full House.
Oh.
And it's like, yeah, so it's already like the original scene is already nostalgic.
Yeah.
Like
they're like
it's a scene where it's already like they're already doing this like nostalgic bullshit, and then it cuts to a split screen of them doing it 20 years later. And that it's like, how is this not?
They're beating you over the head with a reference, just like bonking you over the head. Like, hey, we're doing a reference now. It's like, it's pretty much it's a weird fourth wall break, really.
It's very strange. That show is very fucking disorienting.
It's also like so saccharine. It's funny to have, what's his name? The dad, after kind of playing on his, you know,
Bob Saget.
So that show, Bob Saget, to then like lean into like the pervert comedy for 30 years to come back to do like Sesame Street again.
He spent years like building building his stand-up brand on like, Danny Tanner cusses.
Fuck my daughters.
God.
And then he's back at it. Back at it again. But my mom loves Fuller House, and I regret like sort of I came home and my mom's like, oh, I watched all of Fuller House on Netflix, and I was like, oh man, like this is this cultural Ouroboros or whatever. And she's like, I don't think it's nice. And I was like, all right, well, that's, you know, there's definitely an audience for this, and so, you know, maybe I should calm down.
In general, I actually have to say, funny enough, despite my aversion to like an OC one or whatever, they can do it. I just mean me, but but like, actually weirdly in general, I don't kind of mind. I think like there's something, it's so cheap, but I get like excited by, I don't know. It's just like, oh, it's something you liked and they're doing it again. And it just feels like, I don't know. It's like, and even certainly as an actor, when you hear like, oh, they're casting, you know, like there's something cheap and easy to, I don't know. I want to, there's like, you know, they did like, they remade Straw Dogs, like the Screen Gems cheap version. It's such a weird idea. And, you know, I'm sure they didn't make any money on it, but like, you know, 10 years ago now. And it's so cheap, but like still part of me is like, oh, I want to be Dustin Hoffman. I want to be that character. I'd be Dustin Hoffman, even though those two things are very different.
Right.
What's surprising for me, though, is that like so rarely do you see the concept or the story or the scripts updated. You know what I mean? They're doing the update. They're casting actors who are, you know, James Marsden becomes Dustin Hoffman. And I agree with you. When I heard that, it was like, oh, okay, that's interesting because those two dudes are so different. You know, it's like those are not equivalents. And so that makes me interested in where they're headed with this remake. And then you watch the remake and it's exactly the same movie beat to beat to beat to beat. And it's, you know, that's the part of it that confuses me where it's like, what was the hope for it in terms of like, you know, the box office?
Just
like,
what you know?
So,
right. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Have you seen that side by side of in the Air Tonight, that Lion King song?
That's a Phil Collins song.
Can you feel the love tonight or whatever? Can you feel the love tonight? It's like a side by side of like the original and like the new one. And like,
I didn't know there's a new one. There's
the Lion King.
Oh, in the new movie. Okay.
The Lion King remake.
Yeah.
It's like the characters move so statically in the new one, but
yeah, it's so
like,
much worse.
It's just shot for shot.
Right.
And it is. Yeah, like, I don't think they changed anything about, like, the new... I think it is literally just the same script, but, like, new actors. And it is, like, that kind of stuff makes me very cynical, I guess.
We turned that on the other night, because we just got Disney Plus so that we could look at the new Pixar. And we put The Lion King on. And, yeah, you're right. It is shot for shot the same, like the opening song where they have like a shot of the zebra and then a shot of like the meerkats or whatever, like it's they've just rebuilt the entire movie and it's still animated, it's not live action.
So weird. Yeah.
Right. You know,
yeah,
to bring it full circle back to the OC and what we were talking about with Full House, I was thinking that, you know, one reason the remake of it doesn't work is that the setting doesn't work. You know, you look where they live. It's this widower living with a gang of people in San Francisco, like right in a main drag. It just like, it literally could not work in the future. Like they would be a millionaire.
Oh yeah. They've been displaced by,
they have to be fucking billionaires.
Yeah. Tech bros.
And likewise, the OC, if you were to imagine a modern version of it, I mean, with the setting, I guess Orange County's always had a reputation of being right-wing. That being said, things have certainly changed in the world quite a bit. I mean, MAGA and QAnon, I think like so many of the characters, I mean, in real life, Orange County's been completely taken over by anti-mask people, QAnon, MAGA people. I mean, it's just an absolute hotbed, specifically this year. So it's just weird to imagine that show taking place in today's Orange County.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, even some of the actors themselves, I'm not going to name any names. Well, I'll name Kevin Sorbo. You know, I'll name Kevin Sorbo, but he's become one of the top tier MAGA guys in real life.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple OC MAGA turns that happened.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Anna?
And
one third of that Seth Cohen love triangle is now full MAGA.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess Seth made the right choice, I guess. So the point. I wondered like how different was the character of Seth from like you at the time? Like he was like a super music like what was your music taste when you were doing the show? Like what were you listening to? Because like it was super musical show and it was like a massive part of the character.
I think you know, for at least a brief part of the time, they were very, very similar, you know, I think, and I think it kind of fused, what I liked and what Josh Schwartz was into too. You know, I think he wrote this drama and then I did the pilot, and I think because it was so melodramatic, it was pretty easy without even being like a comedian, so to speak, like it was pretty easy to like inject some humor into the very self-serious scenes. And Josh is really funny. So I think he really responded to that. And I was like, oh shit, I can write. That's even more fun for me to write, you know? And then kind of, took a lot of what I was in, you know, so at the time, Death Cab for Cutie was my favorite band. Yeah. And then a lot of the bands, but Schwartz was into all the, you know, the indie music scene very much too. And we'd go to concerts together. And, comic books were more my thing at the time. He didn't have a real background in that. You know, whereas I had a couple phases of my life where I was heavily, heavily invested. And then, so we kind of merged voices for a while, and it was, and then I don't really, I swear to God, the last couple seasons are a blur. I don't remember what happened. It was a different show though. In my fairness, like,
well, seasons one and two, it's a different show.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I without even having seen, you know, the last time I saw it, it was like years ago, and we showed, I think my wife's friend, like, we're like, let's watch the pilot and then like maybe some of the last episode. Yeah. And it just like, and even though it was only four seasons, it was like, there were different planets, could have been on different channels, just different. They didn't even exist in the same. And,
I don't understand what that shift was.
What
because
happened?
I do remember like season three, like they stopped having like any kind of like fun music.
Uh-huh.
And then it was like, I don't know. It just.
Can I weigh in on this? Because I'm a big fan.
Yes, please weigh in,
yes, please, Evan.
For me, okay, the first season of the show is phenomenal, right? And you can tell that it was a show that, what, would you guys have like a 10 episode order originally, and then it was extended to like 28 or something?
Yeah, I think the first season is like 30. They're like, we're picking you up for 7 right now, and then
yeah, like, yeah, incredibly like self-aware.
Yeah, and you can tell that it like the story moves so quickly, right? Which I think becomes the problem later on, is that you guys told so much, like you gave us so much so quickly. Like, you know, Seth and Summer is one thing, but also like Ryan and Marissa, everyone, you know, gets together, then they break up, then they get together again. It's all so accelerated. And you can tell that, like, you know, they're keeping up with the demand, and it's just, you know, everything is self-aware but not self-conscious. And then by the time that you're in season two, the show's broken out and become such a, you know, a cultural phenomena, and you can see that the show is just more self-conscious, it's aware of, you know, the fact that, oh, we presented the audience with like the scandal where an underage boy sleeps with like his girlfriend's mom, and like it's salacious. And it leans harder into that stuff. Whereas I think for me, at least, the original charm of the show, the reason that it surprised me so much, was just the dynamic between the family. You know, like the it wasn't actually the kind of like the scandalous sort of Orange County look at like the you know, what the rich and, you know, get up to, or blah blah blah, look at their kids. It was like the actual kind of wholesome element of everything. And and by the second season, for me, it was like the rules of the world have changed a little bit, where now there's a little more winking at the camera, like now the show is more self-aware. And then for me, by the third season, it was after Trey gets shot, you know what I mean? And now we're the dark show. We're like, you know, it's steeped in tragedy, and
right,
like that there's going to be,
yes,
guns and violence, and, you know, everything is so dark and cold. And, you know, Kelly Rowan's character is getting manipulated by her alcoholic friend, like right out of the gate. Like this is my memory of it. And then I think in the fourth season, it tried to, you know, re-inject, I guess, sort of like the levity and the irony, but in a way that was just very different, like from what Adam was saying, very different from where it began, which was way more grounded, like way more real and way more earnest. And I think as a consequence, just like way more funny and effective.
I appreciate how big of OC nerds us three are. This definitely has the energy of like when Harrison Ford gets interviewed about Star Wars at Comic-Con.
I did talk to Jack about this when we booked the podcast, and I was like, I really like can't let this become the Chris Farley show. Like I really like don't want this to just fucking be me like, oh yeah, oh hey, yeah, so you were on.
Yeah, you're on the OC, you know.
So I'm sorry.
No, two things I'll say about it real fast. One, I agree with Evan. I think that, and for what in today's world, like, yeah, the show's on for four years, but that's like, it was on for 12 seasons of like a streaming show. So, you know, the first season alone is three seasons of fucking Stranger Things or something. So like, I think like it's a real accomplishment. Besides tone or besides anything, I think they cycled through story way too fast and, you know, didn't let anything burn for a whole season. And so, you know, with the Seth and Summer characters, it became a sitcom very fast, which in the moment I appreciated because I didn't like doing the melodrama. I'd prefer to just do like light comedic stuff, but for a 1 hour show that's going to keep you invested 23 hours a year, we would break up at the beginning of every episode and then get back together by the end. Certainly of the last two seasons, as far as I remembered it. And that just doesn't have the same dramatic tension as keeping us apart for two seasons. You know what I mean? And wanting, right. I remember Josh, you know, there was a bad guy. What was his name? There's a bad guy early on that like got Marissa into drugs, like in like episode 5, 6, yeah. Seven, something like that. And Oliver.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Oh yes. Yes.
And the audience hated him so much. I remember Josh was very like, he like would joke about it even in interviews. Like that was my biggest mistake. Oliver. Oh God, the Oliver. I feel so bad about Oliver. And it's like, he felt so bad. And it's like, no, that's great. They were furious. You had him riled up and they wanted to see this come to conclusion. They fucking hated him. And like, that's good. You know, that's more of that. And I think there's a reluctance to do that in the same way that like, oh, people like Seth and Summer together, let's just have them be together all the time versus upsetting the audience. And then also just on a personal note, any clip of it I've seen on Twitter or something, the other reason I'm sort of loath to like get too into it or like hard to, even though I'm so happy with the legacy of it and I'm proud that I got to be, I am a part of pop culture and, you know, the sound of my own fucking voice on that show, even though I was in my mid-20s, it feels like I'm 13 and I'm going through hard puberty. And I just, and not only that, the acting choices I'm making, the fashion, all of it. Like, I can't stomach myself. And any clip I've seen, I haven't given it a real watch, but any clip I've seen makes me want to throw up. So that's another reason that, you know.
Times have changed. I think the weird thing is that, like, because I mean, I was Seth Cohen's age, I think, when it came out, maybe a little younger. But the weird thing is that like so much of what you were wearing was supposed to be like nerdy and emo at the time. But now it's just kind of like regular guy clothes, like the track jackets and shit like that. It's very funny how like emo fashion of that era is just kind of like been absorbed into normal clothes.
It is kind of wild, though. Yeah, there were some costuming decisions on that program. Where it feels like sabotage.
Yeah.
Not so much with Seth Cohen, but I think with like a lot of the there were like some Marissa fits.
You look normal, Adam. You look normal. The other costumes like age. What Brandon's talking about, like,
right?
You're the normal guy.
I've seen some shots. Also, you know, as an actor with the now going on longish career. Hairs are really like ghosts of hair, you know, haircuts are thing. Like,
honestly, we're stands over here. We support
sweet
all of Seth Cohen. I have another question, just kind of round that off. What was it like being in that show at the time? Because like, you're not playing that, the character's similar to you as a person, and also there's these shows that came after, like the imitate, like the Hills and stuff like that, where they're like reality shows. And they're kind of acting and they all kind of got grouped in together. That feels very weird to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, Brandon, do you know what I'm talking about? How the Hills.
I mean, just like that time in culture where there were like reality shows that existed because of the culture created by the OC.
Yeah.
And then like how those bled into each other.
And then you're actually living there in real life as a guy.
But also seemingly kind of an out, kind of an outsider, more of a, it's, I feel like you're not, you were never really like entrenched in like that kind of, in that aspect of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, two things I'll say, like I, even in explaining to someone now who doesn't know me or my work, or I'm having a casual conversation, oh, you're an actor. What do you do? I'm like, well, I'll kind of just go to the OC. I'm like, if you've heard of anything, it's probably that. And I'd say a good third of the time, it's they think I'm Brody Jenner from Laguna Beach.
Oh, no.
Oh God.
And then they're like, oh yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah. Yeah. And then, I don't know. The other thing I guess is that it seems like I'm from San Diego. I've lived in LA for 20 years. I'm definitely a beach bum now more than ever since high school. And I would even consider living there someday, except I never can. I feel like, so it's too embarrassing.
Oh, right.
So, oh, you'd be stopped
and feel a little
constantly
on the nose.
Just too fucking funny.
I mean, you seem like a super, like, I don't know, like, you kind of have different taste than like a lot of the people that were like in that world. You've made like these very like discerning career decisions where, you know, I feel like you've tried to like kind of, you know, and you've successfully pivoted out of that.
Yeah, I don't know.
But,
you know,
was that like weird being like around this, like that, you know, that culture at all? Like, just sort of,
well,
the,
I don't
like,
know. What do you mean by
early 2000s part? Like early 2000s, like party culture of like, you know, like Misha Barton was very
Paris
like in the tabloids.
Yeah.
With like, yeah.
Paris Hilton.
Paris Hilton is in that one episode. Like,
you know, it was very, very insular actually at the time. I think like I hesitate to even, scares me to think about like social media now and what it would have been like in terms of feeling like under a microscope. Yeah. And, but I was 23 when it started. So I wasn't, you know, it's still young, but I wasn't as impressionable as I could have been. Pre-social media, we filmed in Manhattan Beach, like kind of in the middle of nowhere. And I was dating my co-star most of the time. And Josh was dating her best friend. My agent got married to the costumer. They're still married and have three kids. Like, it was so insular. And it was great. It was great fun, you know, for like
right.
The majority of that time, we all just kind of hung out. There was a group of like, you know, circling out to about 30 people, let's say. And so, yeah, I didn't feel, it felt like, I don't know, it felt college. It didn't feel too hedonistic and it didn't feel too dangerous. And
that's
I didn't
great.
Feel, and also I did not feel superior or, you know, in any way, you know, having more of an indie sensibility or something, and I couldn't relate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know. It was all very friendly. It was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I see what Brandon, you mean about like there was a path, there was an alternate path very close that was possible of that time, you know?
Right.
Where with like the Spencer Pratt era when they're on the cover of all the tabloids and stuff. Like,
yeah,
that was,
I mean, listen, I could have, sure. I mean, look, that's true, but
not that you would have.
No, I mean, look, I the deciding factor in me doing the show was Doug Liman directing the pilot, and I was a huge fan of all his previous work. And so I was coming at it from a, and also I was very opportunistic in the, or strategic in a way too, of just like, this can get me, you know, I mean, it wasn't a goal in and of itself. It was also a lot. I felt like it could be a stepping stone and what have you. And it was, and it also is never still to this day. Like I do not feel, and I never have, like it's an albatross or it's something that I gotta like, you know, at the time I was, I guess, fairly precious because I'm like, I'm doing this teen soap by day, my extracurricular work, I'm not trying to forge it. You know, it's just that like, I needed to really represent the other part of me or, you know, my other sensibilities.
Right.
And maybe to the detriment of my career, quite honestly, you know, there's a few opportunities, not many because that show filmed like 10 months a year. So we had very little time to kind of do other things. So there wasn't that many opportunities to really branch out anyways during the filming of that show. But, you know, I let a few pass me by because I felt like they were just a little too kind of teen, too light. I don't know. I'd still end up in the same place whether I did them or not. But, you know, a while ago I was thinking, oh, maybe I should have, but.
I mean, it's a great show that still holds up 100% to this day. One of the great shows of that era. I'd say that and Friday Night Lights, two of my favorites of the time, that still hold up hard, heavily. And to bring it back, I'd say because a lot of us still have that really positive nostalgia about that show, I think it made Adam a really good casting choice for Kid Detective.
Yeah.
An early promise and failure.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Positive nostalgia. Recollection of youth.
I don't feel that way, but I've noticed enough reviewers or interviews like there is that question. And for what it's worth, I'm fine with it. And I think in any way that like a viewer might feel that way, it works for the character. It actually like lends it that.
Well, yeah, never. I want to go on record and say I never felt that way because I've been on the Brody train for years now.
No thanks,
Brody. You know, during that, you know, I watch Jennifer's Body every Halloween.
Sweet. Every Halloween. Watching,
wow. You know, every Halloween season, not every Halloween proper.
That's the whole day.
And also Burning Love, I think always gets left out of the conversation. And Adam is very good on Burning Love, which has like a fucking wrecking crew of an ensemble. Yeah. Have you watched Burning Love, Jack?
I've seen some of it, I think.
It's a fucking great show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like,
it's really good.
You know, Michael Cera, Adam, who's Paul Scheer, Rob Hubel. You know, real heater. Yeah. And June Diane Raphael, who's
so
fucking
good.
Amazing.
I could name some more. It's really good.
I'm going to go on record as well, just for safety, that I did not mean it in that way as well. But I mean, I really do think it was a good casting choice because Adam, I mean, you know, it relies a lot on that. And it's easy to have positive memories of this person when they're younger because you watch The OC, even if they're passive, as an intertextual reference.
I mean, Evan, I don't want Evan to get. I want to include Evan.
I'm trying to throw the ball back to Evan right now. I'm trying to throw the ball. You know, I'm trying to do a lateral pass.
Right. Like it relates to what we were saying at the beginning about how like we are relying on a kind of collective nostalgia. You know, people's nostalgia for Kid Detective books is not so different from people's nostalgia for The OC. You know, like we were saying before, it's just a glimpse of a different, simpler, more beautiful world, you know, where the greatest problems are insignificant compared with what we deal with, you know, in our actual world. And so it's true that like you know, as far as like filling in the gaps with this character, you know, it really helps that like for a lot of people, they're sort of like most kind of you know, a special or, you know, most sacred memory of Adam is from The OC, you know, which especially now just feels like, you know, a utopic.
Oh yeah.
World, you know, and those, a world. Yeah.
Those bands performing at the local bait shop. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It's just like literally a fantasy land, you know, it's amazing. But yeah, I mean, Kid Detective, I really don't want to like, I don't want to skip like any opportunity to plug this because I really think everybody needs to see this movie.
Yeah, because we have been trying to ride the line of like not spoiling anything. I do think it is a movie where you should go in knowing as little as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
agreed.
Yeah,
100%.
Like I'm really grateful that I went in knowing like nothing. No, not even a. I didn't watch the trailer. I just watched the movie and loved it. It's like it's so funny and perfect noir, perfect comedy, and just a really like refreshing movie. And it does feel like a movie that is gonna just like for years. I think it's gonna be one of those things where, you know, it's going to be a big word of mouth thing of like, oh, nice. you haven't seen Kid Detective, and then you put them on nice. To it, and they're like, oh, this is the best shit I've seen in my life.
I hope so.
No, I agree.
I love it, and I'm so proud of it, and I hope it.
No, it definitely has that vibe of like, you know, the falling into the major indie movie classics category, 100%.
I mean, that's amazing. Thanks so much, guys. That's that is obviously like the dream with a film like this. You don't have too many like expectations when it comes to like grosses or like what it's going to do with the box office or, you know, any of that stuff. It really is just about hoping it will connect with people who are, you know, like us and, you know, share our sense of humor. Who like share our reverence for like the genre of film noir and detective stories. And, you know, so we're also hopeful that now that it's being released on digital, that, that it's going to, you know, find its audience. And we're just, you know, super pleased, to have you guys plugging it and to hear people
absolutely.
Talking about it. It's the best.
Yeah. I mean, fucking timeless movie. I think it's going to outlive all of us, you know.
I have not found myself laughing out loud at movies this year, but like I was laughing out loud many, many times throughout this movie, which was like always refreshing. Like this year to be like truly laughing hard at a movie, it's like, I don't know, it's rare and always sticks out to me.
Thanks.
How can people watch it, and can you give more detailed info on like how do people watch this and when?
So January 19th, it should be available on all digital platforms. So Amazon, iTunes, Apple TV, you know, whatever your cable provider is, you should be able to rent it. It should be.
So that's tomorrow. When this comes out, that'll be tomorrow.
Is that tomorrow?
It will be. It will be in the future. You know, for us, it's in a week. For them, it's tomorrow. So tomorrow night, I'd say, go watch Kid Detective.
Fire it up. You can be watching it in 24 hours.
Absolutely. Any other final plugs for you guys? I know you have to go to another interview, I think. But Adam, do you have anything you want to plug besides the movie?
Anything I want to plug?
Any final thoughts?
Just, you know, we're in the middle of an impeachment here. And I just hate these motherfuckers so much.
Right.
That's all. They're just traitors to. And when I say I mean Republicans, they're fucking traitors to humankind. Not just they're just or they're rubes. They're gold and they're a bit of both. But these fucking politicians are just criminal. That's all.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy.
I'm glad we're cleaning house. I'm glad. I think times are a changing, and I you know. I'm fairly optimistic about the future, even more so than most of my friends. And so I feel like there's a lot of upheaval, but I think on the other side of this is greener pastures. I think and hope.
I think so too. I mean, I think it's gotten so weird that it's hard to imagine what it was like before. But there was a time, you know.
Yeah, and what's crazy is it's never going to be like that again. You know, that's the thing I keep thinking about is like, we're so far out at sea now, like when Trump's gone, when the vaccine, you know, takes hold, we're still going to be a very different society than we were. And like I said, I think ultimately maybe for the better, but it ain't going to be the OC anymore.
Yeah. OC, like I said, be a very, very different show right now. Very different. Especially with some of the cast, Kevin Sorbo included. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Evan, Evan, Adam, thank you.
Thank you guys for having us.
I was very intimidated.
Yeah,
I was very intimidated going into this because I do know that every woman I've ever had sex with would murder me to have sex with Adam Brody once.
Wow. Maybe no, I'm not gonna comment on it.
All right, thanks guys.
Thanks for coming.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Guys.